We'll continue with the larger and shorter catechisms, what man ought to believe concerning God. Question number 39 of the larger catechism. Question 39, why was it requisite that the mediator should be man? Answer, it was requisite that the mediator should be man, that he might advance our nature, perform obedience to the law, suffer and make intercession for us in our nature, have a fellow feeling of our infirmities, that we might receive the adoption of sons and have comfort and access with boldness unto the throne of grace. Question 38 dealt with why it was requisite the mediator should be God. Question 40 is going to take up the question of the number of persons that we're talking about. I dealt with that a little bit last time in talking about the divinity of the mediator, that we're talking about a divine person. We'll talk about that more next time with respect to the singleness of the person. We'll talk about one person in the relation to the human nature here. That's what we're really talking about. We're talking about the other nature. There's a divine nature, but there's also a human nature that is assumed by the divine person. And without getting into the reasons and all of that, the assumption of the humanity, some of which will be coming up, as I say, we want to talk about why it's necessary that the mediator should not only be God, but man. Why there should not only be a divine nature, but a human nature. Why we have to look for this other nature in terms of what we know about redemption. And that's really, really how we come to know that this is requisite. And we'll see that in a number of the points that we're going to canvas tonight. We're going to talk first about in what sense it was necessary that the divine person assume human nature. That is an interesting question in and of itself, and so I do want to talk about that a little bit. There are, as we're going to see, certain things which could not have transpired. The things which benefit man that would not have, in fact, occurred had there not been this assumption of the humanity. And so there's a sense in which when we say, why was it requisite or necessary the mediator should be man, we're raising questions that have to do not simply with redemption in the sense of forgiveness of sins and all of that. That's true, but the forgiveness of sin and the upholding of the humanity in the sacrifice for sin, the atonement, is really predicated upon the divinity of Christ. But the assumption of the humanity does something peculiar for man himself, for the human nature. And it's really spelled out in the very first phrase, that he might advance our nature. We're going to talk about that and what that means in a very real sense, why that's an important thing, that this idea that he might advance our nature. You know, had God redeemed man in a way that didn't really involve the human nature, there wouldn't have been this elevation of humanity. And so in the assumption of a human nature, there's more that goes on in redemption than just simply the forgiveness of sins. Something, a benefit or a series of benefits which accrue to man that would not otherwise accrue. At least that's what the Bible indicates. And we'll see that as we go over some of these verses. So, this is the other side of the question of the two natures in the one person. We talked about the divine nature, we're going to talk about the human nature, and what that brings to the table, if you will, in the great matter of salvation. The first question is, in what sense was it requisite that the mediator should be man? Now, when we talk about necessity, the necessity here, in fact, of assuming humanity, the necessity is a little bit different than there was with respect to the divine nature. The fact that is it requisite that the mediator, a divine person, have a divine nature, there's a natural necessity there. We're not dealing with that in that sense. And so we're going to have to clarify that. So first thing to note is this, that the necessity of the mediator being man ought not to be understood in any absolute sense, as if God must do by a necessity of his nature. Okay? This is not something God must do by any necessity of his nature, being man. Look at Luke 1:37.
Luke 1:37. For with God nothing shall be impossible.
With God nothing shall be impossible. In other words, there's nothing here regarding the creation. And when we talk about the nature of man, we're talking about a created nature. There's nothing here that God, that is a divinity, requires. There's no necessity of nature there that God should become man. Right? That's not the kind of necessity. Instead, we should understand that what we're talking about is a conditional necessity, which was a means to accomplish God's purpose in redemption. And that's indicated if we look at Isaiah 53:10 and Luke 24:46.
Isaiah 53:10. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath not put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand.
Luke 24:46. And said unto them, thus it is written, and thus it behooved Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead the third day.
It behooved Christ. It was necessary that Christ die and be raised again. Why? Not because of necessity of nature, but because this is the plan that God has adopted. So the necessity is a necessity which comes into play conditionally. Had God not decreed to save man or to save man in this way, there would be no necessity that God become man. There would be no necessity that the mediator should be a man, that he should assume a true humanity, true human nature. That is entirely out of the picture when we talk about absolute necessity or necessity of nature. Right? It was just not necessary in that way. But the plan of redemption makes it necessary. That's why we call it a conditional necessity. Given the fact that God has and has this plan, this purpose, that makes it necessary. And so, as Christ was ordained to be mediator between God and man, it was requisite that he become man. 1 Timothy 2:5.
1 Timothy 2:5, for there is one God, one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus.
Yeah, it's part of being a mediator, a go-between, is you have to be, in some sense, to be a mediator, you've got to be somehow related to both parties. To bear a relation to both. If he's only God, there's really no relation that's being born that is in the sense that we need it here in, for redemptive purposes. There's no organic connection. There's no natural connection. But when he assumes a humanity, when he assumes human nature, there is now a natural connection to mankind. Right? There is created in that assumption a tie to humanity that's far beyond the tie of a creator and creature. It goes from being being purely objective, sitting in an objective seat, to one which is subjective. And that's really necessary for a mediator. A mediator, ideally any mediator, is going to be one who is subjectively communing with both parties, in a sense. You have some foot, if you will, in both camps. You're go-between precisely because you kind of fit in both places. Well, if the mediator is only God, that doesn't really hold. And so, mediation, really, between God and man is predicated upon this very connection or bridge being created. And, by the way, this is a bridge, it couldn't have come from another direction. We'll talk about this probably a little bit more when we talk about the person who assumes humanity. Why isn't there a human person assuming the divinity, if you will? Why didn't he go in the other direction? It's just simply impossible for the creature to bridge that gap between the creator and the creation. If there's going to be a bridge, it has to come from the other direction. It can't come from our direction. We can't jump that high or swim that far. We can't make the gap go away. God, on the other hand, being infinite, is able very easily to overcome that obstacle from his perspective, from his point of view, should he wish. Again, he doesn't do it by necessity of nature. He does it by reason of what we would call a voluntary condescension. And that voluntary condescension is precisely, then, what makes it requisite or necessary that the mediator should be man. The fact that he's going to do this, that he's got this plan of redemption. And so, this idea that it's requisite the mediator should be man is only an absolute necessity with respect to man himself, whose nature was required to render an obedience to the law in order to make satisfaction for sin. We see this hinted at in Leviticus 17:11.
Leviticus 17:11. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it upon you the altar to make an atonement for your souls. For it is the blood that maketh an atonement for the soul.
Yeah, the blood makes an atonement for the soul. There's this requires a human nature. At the very least, it requires a created nature. As we will see, it really requires a human nature, but it certainly requires a created nature. And precisely a nature that is able to bleed. Right? Not just an angel. We'll come back to that in a moment, but there's more that's required than an angelic creature could fulfill when we're talking about this. And so it's not just the brute beast aspect that, you know, you have a body that can bleed and die. No, what's involved is the redemption of your soul. And so there's a necessity really of the possession of a reasonable soul together with a true body to make this kind of atonement possible. Now, without both, you're not really going to make an atonement. And there, the combination of those two is why we know that what is in view ultimately is going to be a human nature. And the Jews should have known that from the very wording of the law, that the blood of bulls and goats was only really there to teach them something outwardly, but they were always really looking at something much more than that, because it had to do with the soul as well as the body. And that obedience to the law that's going to be required to make atonement, to make satisfaction, that obedience has to be rendered in the nature that is offended, ultimately. Again, from the wording of the law, they should have known this, and I think at some level they did know. In fact, I believe that those who were true believers understood that this atonement would be wrought definitively when Messiah came. And the law's pointing to that. So the necessary obedience could not be performed by him in his divine nature, because we have to remember that divine nature is not under any obligation to perform what pertains only to the creature as a subject. Look at Romans 5:19.
Romans 5:19, for as by one man's disobedience many were made sinners, so by the obedience of one shall many be made righteous.
So by the obedience of one. Now, wait a minute. Obedience. That obedience is the result of coming under an obligation to perform what is necessary to the keeping of the law. Is God bounded to or by the law? I know there's some people who have been confused about this, but the fact is God is not bounded by the law. The law is God's expression of desire toward the creature. Now, God couldn't possibly break any of these laws. You know, it's not going to happen. God can't unlawfully kill. All souls are his. Everything belongs to him. He can't possibly steal because everything belongs to him. Like, none of these laws are bounding or in any way are they impinging upon him. And they're not, contrary to what some even Reformed theologians have said, the law is not an expression of the divine nature per se. The law is an expression of the divine nature with respect to the creation of the creature. But it's not an expression of how God is, if you will. All right? It's an expression of what kind of relation the creature ought to bear to the Creator and to the rest of the creation. Now, the divine nature can't be brought under any obligation to any of that. Right? The divine nature is in no way circumscribed. Once we go down that road and start making this kind of assertions, what we're saying is that God limited himself in some way by creating. And the fact is, God didn't limit himself by creating. That's not what brought about the limitation, if we're going to say there's a limitation. God's limitation is brought about by a voluntary purposing to do this rather than that. Right? There's no necessity of nature. There's certainly nothing arising in the creation which is imposing an obligation on God. Just because God creates, contrary to what a lot of people think, he's not obligated in any way to that creation by nature. Now, he may, in fact, bind himself to be obliged voluntarily. But there's no natural obligation that belongs to God. You know, this idea that if God didn't do this or didn't do that, it wouldn't be fair. It's false reasoning. You know, it's an attempt to elevate the creature over the Creator and to dictate to the Creator what is or is not acceptable, what he can or cannot do with what is his own. And that doesn't pertain. So the divine nature can't be brought under any obligation to perform what pertains only to a creature to perform. So in order for this performance, that there has to be an obedience to the law in order to make a satisfaction, in order for there to be that obedience, and for it really to be an obedience, it has to be carried out not by the subsisting of a person in a divine nature, but rather by the subsisting of that person in a true humanity, a true human nature. Because the nature that sinned, that is the nature in and through which this atonement must be made. That's the point of these laws in Leviticus, like the one we looked to. So the necessity that the mediator become man is not an absolute necessity of nature for God, but it is an absolute necessity for man. Okay? But that's a different kind of necessity, because what is absolutely necessary for man is really a contingency, because all of creation is dependent and contingent upon the Creator. But we can call it an absolute necessity, because with respect to the creature, it is absolutely necessary. It's been made that by the command and rule of God. Where God said it has to be this way. Now, furthermore, we can say this. According to the great ends designed by the Incarnation, it was required that no other created nature, such as the angelic, be taken into union with the divine, because the same obedience was to be yielded to the law which had been violated, necessitating he be made of a woman. Galatians 4:4.
Galatians 4, verse 4. But when the fullness of the time was come, God sent forth his Son, made of a woman, made under the law.
And this becomes a little bit more nuanced now, but we need to understand that the angels themselves are not under the law. I'm not saying they're not under a law, but for example, angels are neither given in marriage or taken in marriage. So how can or would the seventh commandment come into play with angels? You know, angels have no reason to touch your stuff. They have no need of physical items. They're not going to add anything to their glory. So all of these laws couldn't possibly pertain to angels. Some of them, perhaps, but not all of them. And even those that, in some sense, thou shalt have no other gods before me, and not worshiping graven images, and that sort of thing, not taking the name of the Lord in vain. Yeah.
Do you think that since each angel is created as an individual, there will be like an individual law for each angel?
That may well be. Or certainly may be tailored to them. There may be sort of differences. You know, each one, after all, is being given explicit orders tailored to them. They're not, they're not really being addressed or going to be addressed in the same way. The Ten Commandments are a series of laws which befit our nature, but they don't even they don't tell us every detail of what we need to do, right, with respect to our daily activities. So, he who is to be our Redeemer was required to run the same race with us, and part of what that required was sufferings of the body as well as the soul as a consequence of our rebellion. Look at Hebrews 2:10.
Hebrews 2, verse 10. For it became him for whom are all things, and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons into glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings.
Yeah, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. And you see, had he just assumed an angelic nature, there wouldn't have been the kind of sufferings that he was enabled to endure, including the suffering on the cross. That wouldn't have been possible for an angelic being, an angelic nature to experience. It's something which requires the presence of a body. For him to suffer, being, for example, just the infirmities, being tired, being hungry, those kinds of things pertain to having a body, and they're not something that would necessarily pertain to being pure, intelligent spirit beings like angels. So, you know, the angels are clearly intelligent creatures, but the lack of a body and the fact that their nature does not require this union with a body, a true body, that would disqualify the angelic nature from being a possibility when we're talking about the plan of redemption, what God has in fact set forth as being the way in which man must be saved, that the atonement and satisfaction for sin has to be accomplished in this way. Not least of which, of course, is the pouring out of his blood. You know, angels don't have blood. We have no reason to think that they have any kind of physical attributes, although we do know that they can appear to have that. They can, in fact, present themselves in that way, and yet they're always referred to as being spirit beings and not as beings having true bodies in the sense of you know, spatially, locally present physicalities. So, Christ, the mediator, in order to accomplish this redemption, in order really to perform obedience to the law, which, although it's our second point in the catechism, is really in the forefront of what we're discussing right now. In order to that performance, it is really necessary that he become man. You know, apart from that humanity, that assumption of humanity, he can't possibly perform in obedience to the law. You know, we have no reason to think the angelic nature is under that law that man is under. Certainly not in the same way. It makes absolutely no sense to tell an angel to remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. All right. In addition to that, it makes no sense to ascribe to angelic beings those kinds of attributes necessary for a bodily suffering, which is certainly part of the suffering that the mediator is going to have to accomplish in the course of performing an obedience to the law. And because every obedience in the Bible, all obedience, in order to be genuine obedience, it has to be an obedience which arises from a voluntary acquiescence to the performance of duty. Okay, if you do something, if you're outwardly obedient, that's not really accounted obedience in terms of what the Bible is looking for, in terms of what God is seeking. Right? He's looking not just on the outward, but the inward comportment. And so without a voluntary acquiescence in the performance of duty, you can't have that. And yet, without a humanity, a true humanity, if the mediator cannot in fact live the life of a true man, then he's A, not in a position to offer this obedience, because he's not, strictly speaking, under the law, as he is God. And B, he would not be able to offer that voluntary obedience from that true nature that is required for the actual acceptable obedience that's being sought here in order to make satisfaction for sin. So when we talk about the performance of obedience to the law, the reason we're discussing that first is because I think that one, of all of them, is the point that tells us, or is the cue that is explaining to us precisely why, from the point of view of man, and really from the point of view of being a mediator between God and man, it's necessary that Christ be man. Now, there are some other things that come along with that. The story doesn't end there. His assumption of a true humanity is necessary to that performance of obedience to the law, and for all that is required there. But that doesn't end the story, because the assumption of true humanity, and I think the reason they put first what we're putting second, is this. By reason of that assumption, as we'll see, there is an elevation of humanity. And each of these other points, I think, are really revolving around this great truth. That once God of all, think of this, it's not by necessity of nature that God enters the creation, descends into the creature. He does it voluntarily. And of all the natures, created natures, into which he could descend, there's one he chooses, which is a human nature. That union signifies and does something very interesting with that nature that, in a sense, is hinted at, I think, in the fact that throughout the Old Testament, for example, we've got all these stories of, you know, despite the law of primogeniture, the idea that the eldest would inherit everything and be responsible for everything, we have this picture of the eldest getting disqualified and the younger moving into his place, right? The second son scenario. We know from the Bible that the angels fell. They didn't. A lot of the angels didn't keep their first estate. And man, in a sense, is that second intelligent creation. Man actually is occupying a mediating position, really, between the angels and all of the lower creation anyway. And by assuming humanity, then, God assumes a relation to all of the creation at the point at which all of the creation is in a mediating position. Angels are intelligent spirits, but they don't have bodies. Animal life, they have bodies, but they don't have intelligent spirits. Man is in the mediating position. And by that assumption, there's already an assumption of a mediating position, if you will. That has the effect of singling out the human nature as something quite unique and special with respect to all the rest of creation. And so there's an advancement or an elevation, which we're going to talk about now. It's a question two. What are some of the other necessities requiring the humanity of the mediator? Answer. These necessities demonstrate the mediator must also be man. First, the union of the humanity with the divinity in the person of the mediator accrues to our nature a very great honor by which it is advanced. Look at Hebrews 2:16.
Hebrews 2, verse 16. For verily he took not on him the nature of angels, but he took on him the seed of Abraham.
Again, he didn't take on himself the nature of angels, right? That might have made sense. I mean, after all, if you're the creator, why wouldn't you assume the highest nature? Why go to the next one down in the pecking order? Why not the angelic nature? Well, we're not entirely told, although again, I think that maybe there are hints of it. But God's purposing here, whatever it may be, has the effect of elevating the human nature over the angelic nature. And we'll see some of the consequences of that as we proceed. But there's an advancing then. Because all of a sudden, in the narrative of creation, angels, who might appear to be at the pinnacle of the creation, right, being the most intelligent and pure spirit being, most like God, they're kind of pushed off to the side for a nature which is less like God, a nature which is mediating between the angel and the rest of the lower creation. That would appear to be a promotion. Why that there would be a promotion like that is very hard for us to even conceive, especially when we conceive that man fell. Right? Well, I don't know why God would promote man. It makes no sense, right, from our point of view. But that he did it, well, that's clear. That it is required, well, we've already talked about how there is this necessity for man, for his redemption. So, though the human nature had no intrinsic dignity or glory above what other intelligent, finite, sinless beings are capable of, for example, 2 Samuel 14:20,
2 Samuel 14, verse 20. To fetch about this form of speech hath thy servant Joab done this thing, and my Lord is wise according to the wisdom of an angel of God to know all things that are in the earth.
Now, wise according to the wisdom of an angel of God, right? How much more wise could you be as a creature? And he's clearly talking about sinless beings and all of that. And yet, although human nature has no intrinsic dignity or glory above, for example, the angelic, it does have a greater relative glory than any creature had or can have, simply considered. Look at 1 Peter 1:12.
1 Peter 1, verse 12. Unto whom it was revealed that not unto themselves, but unto us, they did minister the things which are now reported unto you by them that have preach the gospel unto you with the Holy Ghost sent down from heaven, which things the angels desired to look into.
Which things the angels desire to look into, and I've talked about this in other contexts. The Greek there indicates the angels are sort of stooping down, trying to look in, like looking into someone's basement window. And they're bent over, they're trying to see in, they don't get it. So Peter is telling us that we actually have a wisdom and knowledge, relatively speaking, exceeding that of angels. Consider this. You know, when the angels kept not their first estate, when they fell, God cast them down into everlasting chains, right? Imagine you're the elect angels. And man falls. Well, you know what happened when the angels fell. There was no redemption. There was no moment of pause on the part of the divinity. They were lost forever. Right? They were cut off from any possibility of mercy or return. And man falls, and all of a sudden, God does something very different with respect to man than he did with respect to the angels. And Peter's saying, in a sense, they're scratching their heads over this still. They don't understand this. And I'm not saying that we fully understand, but we actually are on the receiving end. And there is an understanding, an experimental knowing that we have that the angels will never have. Those of us who are redeemed will know something of that which the elect angels or the fallen angels will never know. The fallen angels will never know what it's like to be redeemed. The elect angels will never know what it was like to fall. Those who are redeemed by Christ will know both. And so there is a relative glory that accrues to that, because, of course, in order to bring salvation, God has assumed not the angelic nature, but the human nature, seed of Abraham. So despite all of their wisdom and knowledge, They have no knowledge of this matter of redemption. And they're doing what God tells them to do, but they really can't understand it. Now, the elevation of this union is like that of the body, which, apart from the soul, is a thing of itself composed of dust and consigned to the grave. Look at Genesis 3:19.
Genesis 3:19, "In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground, for out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return."
Okay, this, the addition of the soul adds an excellence and dignity to the body, which it didn't previously possess. When I look at Genesis 2:7 and 1:27.
Genesis 2:7, "And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul."
Genesis 1, verse 27, "So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them."
So God breathes the breath of life into man, becomes a living soul. What was he apart from that? Just dirt. Dust. Clay. That union of soul and body elevated the body of the man. That is to say, it elevates the lower creation by being joined to us. What we're saying is that in an analogous manner, the assumption of the human nature to the divine is likewise elevating to the humanity. Right? Just as the lower matter that is that composes your body is elevated by reason of being joined to a reasonable soul, and you become a reasonable soul when God breathes life into you, that analogously is what is happening when the Son of God, the eternal Son of God, assumes a genuine, a true humanity. That there's an elevation. So, that the human nature of Christ being united to the divine is an advancement of the human creature over that of any other and confers a greater degree of honor so that man can now be friends. John 15, 15.
John 15, verse 15. "Henceforth I call you not servants, for the servant knoweth not what his Lord doeth. But I have called you friends, for all things that I have heard of my Father I have made known unto you."
And it, we're not going to remain as the angels, mere servants of God. Hebrews 1:14.
Hebrews 1:14. "Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation?"
And thus, though created a little lower than the angels, as we see in Psalm 8:5.
Psalm 8:5. For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor.
Right. By reason of this advancement, that is the union of the human nature with the divine in Christ, man shall exercise greater authority over them, that is, over the angels. 1 Corinthians 6:3.
1 Corinthians 6:3. "Know ye not that we shall judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life?"
So what's happened? How did this happen? I mean, and what angels are we talking about that we're going to judge? Probably the fallen angels. Okay. How did it come about that man would be in this position of being advanced? We're no longer just servants, but friends. Having even knowledge above that of angels. Well, it's not by reason of our creation. Right? Our creation, we were created a little lower than the angels. We were placed in a position in the order of creation where we were just south of where the angels are in terms of glory. We're not quite there. You know, they're the pinnacle. They're really, in that sense, the crown of creation. because they represent a creation that is most like God and most most conformed to his image in many respects, at least you would think, right? They're intelligent spirit beings. But by reason of this hypostatic union, by reason of Christ assuming a true humanity, man, the nature of man, is elevated from the position of its original creation, and it's actually brought not just on par with the angels, but we're actually advanced above them by reason of this move. Okay, so we're not just brought up one degree on the ladder, if you will, to being that of angelic, but because the eternal Son of God has assumed human nature, not angelic nature, man has been advanced above the angels. There's been an improvement that, in some of the results of this, we're going to look at, because they're mentioned in the other propositions here in this question. Man has been advanced beyond his original creation. This wouldn't have happened if the humanity were not joined to the divinity in Christ. Any more than, again, on an analogous plane, you know, if I form a body out of wet clay, it's just a hunk of wet clay. When God breathes life into it, that life elevates the clay, necessarily. You know, that clay becomes more important, which is why we recognize this. I mean, Jewish and Christian tradition has bestowed great care upon the disposal of the bodies of the dead. Why? I mean, they're just clay, right? Well, they were clay which was occupied at one point by the spirit of man. And all of our, without getting into the excesses of the modern American funerary system, but all of our rites and ceremonies regarding death, the decent burial of the body, And that sort of thing. All of it harkens back to this idea that that hunk of clay, that dead body, is more particularly important because of its association with a person. And it elevated that. I mean, to this day, we have laws on the books against desecration of a corpse. Why? We're really... who have you wronged? You know, what horrible thing have you really done? Of course, as we become more secular and less concerned about things of that sort, it'll be harder and harder, I'm sure, to enforce those kind of laws until they finally go by the wayside altogether. But we may not quite ever get there, because even it would appear that even the pagans have had some notion of the importance of the disposal of the body. It's the association that clay was advanced. And when the Son of God takes into union, hypostatic union, personal union with himself, the human nature, there's an advancement. An advancement that not only gives us greater knowledge in matters of redemption, which the angels desire to look into. They don't understand it. They don't know it. It gives us the ability to be friends with God, not just servants of God. And ultimately, it is the basis upon which we will judge the angels. It's as if all of the order in nature has been set on its head, if you will, when it comes to men and angels. We're sort of switching places, if you will. And a large part of this is the result of the hypostatic union. All right, second, and this is also important, and this is something that I alluded to earlier, but we need to focus on a little bit more, and that is the humanity of Christ is the basis upon which Christ suffered. Look at Hebrews 2:4.
Hebrews 2, verse 14.
Or 2:14, yes.
For as much then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise took part of the same, that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is the devil.
Yeah, through death he might destroy him with power over death, and he might suffer and all of that. How would the divine nature die? It can't. It can't be made subject to death. It's not in any way able to be made subject to death. How does the divine nature suffer? It can't. The divine nature is impassible. It's not passion. There are no changes or vicissitudes of turning. Right? It's not in fluctuation. There's no, it's not liable to change. The human nature is. The human nature is made subject to time, to the law, to all of the limiting factors of the creation. And by reason of sin, it's made subject to death as well. So the humanity of Christ provides the very basis upon which Christ can suffer. And as I noted before, suffering is necessary to the making of an atonement. Right? We can also see the suffering, though, makes him a sympathetic priest for man. Hebrews 2:18.
Hebrews 2:18. For in that he himself hath suffered being tempted, he is able to succor them that are tempted.
He's able to be sympathetic. Why? Because he shares in our suffering. You know, our suffering is not something alien to him. Remember what we just talked about with the angels. They don't really understand redemption. They don't understand what we're going through. You know, they either fell and were lost forever, or they kept the first estate and were confirmed in their holiness. That is not a recipe for sympathy. Angels can't sympathize with us. By the way, that's why they really can't be our friends. Your friends are people who can sympathize with you. You know, when we talk about Christ assuming humanity, this is how God becomes our friend. Why? Well, there's a point of contact. He can sympathize with us. You know, there's a point at which he can say, I get that. Not just from a knowledge point of view. We're going to come back to this in the third point. But it's important to understand that this ability to sympathize, which we'll talk about more in a minute, that's what makes him a sympathetic priest. And that's important because that's a very big component of his intercession, which is really what we're what we're getting at, suffering and making intercession for us in our nature. It's important because of the factor of sympathy. You know, he's sympathetic. So it should be considered as well that divine nature, properly speaking, cannot be said to make intercession. The reason is this. Intercession, properly speaking, intercession includes worship, which belongs only to a dependent and needy person, which Christ could not be apart from his assumed humanity. Look at Hebrews 5, verse 7.
Hebrews 5, 7. Who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard in that he feared.
He was heard in that he feared. Why did he fear? What is all that? This is telling us that he is, in fact, worshiping. He's interceding. And he's able to do it strictly on the basis of his assumed humanity. Because his divinity could never be dependent or needy. And so, in order for him personally to experience dependency and to be a needy person, he has to do that through his assumed humanity. The divinity is not worshiping the divinity. God doesn't worship himself. Worship is the proper response of the creature to the creator. An intercession, having bound up with this idea of worship, that means that there has to be a creaturely element involved for this really to be intercession. For there to be strong cries being offered up, you know, and that kind of fear that we just saw. Right, so the human nature then, being exposed to the infirmities of man, is the foundation of the exercise of his priesthood and intercession for the saints. Hebrews 7, 24 and 25.
Hebrews 7, 24 and 25. But this man, because he continueth ever, hath an unchangeable priesthood. Wherefore he is able also to save them to the uttermost that come unto God by him, seeing he ever liveth to make intercession for them.
He ever liveth to make intercession for them. And again, how? It has to be his humanity. He ever liveth to make intercession means that that true humanity continues with him forever. Right? It has to. Because that is the basis upon which there is this sympathy. There is, in fact, a point of connection. You know, he is a high priest, not unfamiliar, but intimately familiar with what we go through, sin only excluded. But you know, that's like saying he doesn't get to experience some of the sinful pleasures. Remember, he still is going to suffer all the consequences for the sin. Right? He is exposed to all the infirmities that man experiences. He just doesn't know those things that pertain to man that are known only in sinning. Now, that said, I would be inclined to say that in all sinning, there's not really any knowledge being gained. What's being gained is contrary to knowledge. It's no more the basis of knowing, or it's not a positive thing in any way. It's just simply a void. It's sort of sin is a moral cancer. But it's not really something that's there, it's what's not there. Because when you're done sinning, there's something missing. So it's not that he was missing anything, because you can't miss what isn't really something. Sin is, remember, a want of conformity unto, or transgression of the law of God. It's not something positive. So in all of these other things, the limitations that pertain to our humanity, including the limitations which have been imposed because of our sin, Christ has gained an experimental knowledge, sense, which is what we're going to talk about next. Third, then. The humanity, as mentioned, is the reason that Christ has a fellow feeling, is what the Catechism calls it, a fellow feeling of our infirmities, Hebrews 4:15.
Hebrews 4, verse 15. For we have not an high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin.
Yeah, he's without sin, but he's experienced all our infirmities, including temptation. Now, he didn't experience temptation as we do who are already sinners by nature. As the Bible tells us, there's nothing in him. Temptation comes to him like it should have to the first Adam. It had no place in him. It had no hold on him. And there were no hooks. There was nothing that should have drawn him out in that perverted and perverse direction. There was no defect in the creation. The defect arose in the personal exercise of that humanity, that human nature by Adam. The defect is a personal defect that corrupts the entire nature. Christ experiences everything that Adam would have experienced and more. Everything that we can experience as a result of the fall, sin only excluded. Now, why is that important? Well, we know this. As to his true Godhead, Christ had a perfect or divine knowledge of our infirmities. Look at Psalm 139, 1-6.
Psalm 139, verses 1 through 6. O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my downsitting and mine uprising. Thou understandest my thought far off. Thou compassest my path. And my lying down, unacquainted with all my ways. For there is not a word in my tongue, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Thou hast beset me behind and before, and laid thine hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high, I cannot attain unto it.
Right. So the divinity, the God knows by perfect divine knowledge everything. And yet, what he couldn't know, what he couldn't have, was an experimental knowledge of these infirmities had he not been man. And we know this. There are a couple of things. I want to look at something that's said in Exodus 29:3, which I think has bearing on this, and then I look at Hebrews 5, verse 2.
Exodus 29:23, verse 9. Also thou shalt not oppress a stranger, for ye know the heart of a stranger, seeing ye were strangers in the land of Egypt.
In Hebrews 5, verse 2. Who can have compassion on the ignorant and on them that are out of the way? For that he himself also is compassed with infirmity.
Okay. So the first thing, in the giving of the law, God says to the Hebrew people, look, you know what it's like to be a stranger. Be kind to strangers because you know what it was like. You were a stranger. He's appealing to an experimental knowledge that they had. And this is a knowledge that he does not yet have. I say yet. There is, I think, some reason to believe that there was an experimental knowledge of this from the beginning of the creation. If we look at Christ being lamb slain from the foundation of the world, there is there's something to that. It's not that God was ever really without this knowledge. That this knowledge is coterminous in some respect with the creation. And yet it becomes real experimental knowledge at the time of the incarnation. Right? And that's what is alluded to again and so many times in Hebrews, but Hebrews 5:2. He's compassed about with like infirmities. He knows what our situation is like. He has a fellow feeling. He's here with us. You know, he knows. He knows what it's like to suffer. He knows what it's like to be hungry. He knows what it's like to be tired. He knows what it's like to laugh. You know, to weep, to be weary, to be exhilarated. The various things that come to humanity, he comes to know all of that through an experimental knowledge. And that is the basis upon which there's sympathy, as I said before. You know, had there been no experimental knowledge, he wouldn't be able to sympathize with us in all of our infirmities, as he clearly did and does. Isaiah 53:4-5.
Isaiah 53:4-5. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed.
So much of the language the prophet uses there is language that's telling us that he experienced these infirmities. He bore them, our griefs, our sorrows. He had them. They were part of him. And so this is why, for example, we see from his incarnation, and we're told that Christ actually learns. Right? It's not the divine nature learning, but the divine person is learning experimentally. That there is some kind of learning from his incarnation. Christ learned the difficulties of obedience with respect to the passions of the human nature. Hebrews 5:8.
Hebrews 5:8. Though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered.
Yeah, though he were a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. What does that mean? That seems like an insane thing to say about one who is himself the Son of God. And yet, that's exactly what's in view here. There is an experimental knowledge. He's learning through the things which he's suffering. He's gaining an experimental knowledge that God himself does not have, though he has a perfect or divine knowledge of all things, yet he does not have that subjective or experimental knowledge that comes with the incarnation. So he's learned it, that from that point of view, from our point of view. He comes to know our point of view from the inside out. And from what he once experienced, he's moved to help our infirmities, as being such as he himself condescended to bear.
Romans 8:34. Who is he that condemneth? It is Christ that died, yea, rather that is risen again, who is even at the right hand of God, who also maketh intercession for us.
Yeah, so his sufferings and intercession and his fellow feeling of our infirmities, these are really all interrelated things. You know, his suffering is clearly rooted in his assumed humanity. He learns obedience through suffering. He learns what it's like to be man in his incarnation. And that commonality that he experiences with man in the assumption of the human nature is, we're told again and again, the very basis upon which he offers up intercession for the saints. And he's not simply praying for us as an outsider. You know, it's one thing to pray for someone who's going through something and you just don't understand it. Never been there. So far beyond your scope of experience that you pray for them, but you probably are not going to pray for them with a real sense of anything that they're experiencing. The point is, when Christ prays for us, he prays not only with sort of that objective knowledge of this is happening, but with the subjective or experiential knowledge of this is what it's like to go through that. And so he's praying for us not just as, you know, pity the poor creature, but as one who himself learned the obedience of the creature through the assumption of our humanity. Now, the assumption of the humanity, there are a couple more things that are listed here at the end of the question that we need to talk about briefly. The fourth point, the humanity of Christ has made possible our adoption as sons. Well, look first at Galatians 4, verse 5.
Galatians 4, verse 5, to redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons.
We might receive the adoption of sons. So what he's done, he has made possible our adoption as sons. And that's something that's hinted at, right, with regard to what we're told about predestination. Right? The descent. And this is something I mentioned at the very beginning. The descent of the Son of God into our nature has brought to realization the predestinating purpose to bring men into the adoption of children of God. But
Ephesians
1, 5.
Ephesians 1, verse 5. Having predestinated us unto the adoption of children by Jesus Christ to himself, according to the good pleasure of his will.
So what he's done by assuming our nature, that is by descending into our nature rather than the nature of angels or what have you, it has in some way made possible this idea of adoption as sons. Now why is that? This is, I think, very important. Who has assumed our nature? The eternal Son of God. Once the eternal Son of God assumes our nature, it means that as to his humanity, he was and remains still the eternal Son of God. So that our humanity now is in fact rolled up in this assumption, and our that rolling up of our humanity into his person means that the Son, the eternal Son, is also truly man. So that one who is truly man is also truly the Son of God. That opens the door to the possibility then of other men being the children of God. He's the natural son. By assuming our nature, he's brought our nature into a position of being in a place of sonship. And that makes possible the transference of that concept of sonship to all men, particularly to men who are now in him. We're in that humanity. And if our allegiance, you know, our personhood subsists in human nature, and in this life right now, we vacillate between the old man and the new. But in the resurrection, there'll be no divided loyalties. By the way, that's why I think Paul says that waiting for the adoption of sons, to wit, the redemption of our bodies, that will be the final movement of our position and establishing of us solely and wholly in that human nature which Christ has assumed himself. And that will make us sons. Right? Not natural sons, but adopted sons. But Christ being constituted the heir of all things, in Hebrews 1:2.
Hebrews 1, verse 2, hath in these last days spoken unto us by his Son, whom he hath appointed heir of all things, by whom also he made the worlds.
Right. Believers who are sons of God in a lower sense are also constituted heirs by reason of his incarnation. Look at Romans 8:17.
Romans 8:17. And if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ, if so be that we suffer with him, that we may be also glorified together.
Joint heirs of Christ by faith, right? So, faith in Christ is that which constitutes this relation of sons of God. Yeah, look at Galatians 3:27.
Galatians 3:27. For as many of you as have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ.
And put on Christ. From that we see that by faith we take hold of the mediator who has in his humanity accomplished our redemption. Galatians 4:7.
Galatians 4:7. Wherefore thou art no more a servant but a son, and if a son, then an heir of God through Christ.
Thus then those who believe receive him, and to them he gives the power to be sons. John 1:12.
John 1:12, but as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on him.
So again, by faith we become in Christ, we're children of God. Actually, if you look at Galatians 3:26, he calls them there the sons of God. The fact is that we become sons by faith. There is an implanting of us into that nature. We are in Christ, he is in us, and that transference by faith, that entails, among other things, this adoption of sons. If he is a natural son, then we are sons by reason of faith in him. And that's a theme. We become children of God. So this is really, again, this is part of the advancement of our nature. Right? We don't remain simple creatures. We're now the children of God by faith. We're sons. And as sons, they're objects of God's fatherly sympathy and pity. Look at Psalm 103:13.
Psalm 103:13. Like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him.
And therefore, when it's necessary to correct them, he has for them the compassion of a father and chastens them out of that love. Hebrews 12:5-6.
Hebrews 12:5-6. And ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth.
And by reason of his sonship, believers are made heirs of the grace of life. 1 Peter 3:7.
1 Peter 3:7. Likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered.
And heirs of the kingdom of grace, James 2:5.
James 2:5. Hearken, my beloved brethren, hath not God chosen the poor of this world, rich in faith, and heirs of the kingdom which he hath promised to them that love him?
So adoption brings us into a different position with regard to the creation. And again, this is why, as noted earlier, you know, we are in a position to be friends. We're going to judge angels. There's been an advancement of the nature. This is all what this is pointing to. Right? So the advancement of the nature is the total result. The consequence of that advancement are what we're talking about. But the total result of all of these things is there's been an advancement of the nature. This requires an advancing of the nature. We're not simply where man was created. And when Christ comes to restore man, he doesn't just restore him to where Adam was prior to the fall. In fact, he's not restoring him to where the angels that kept the first estate are, but we're actually moved to a position higher than that yet. Okay, so there's an advancement of the nature. And finally, fifth, the adoption of sons makes possible our comfortable approach to God. Romans 8:15.
Romans 8:15. For ye have not received the spirit of bondage again to fear, but ye have received the spirit of adoption, whereby we cry, Abba, Father.
Now, Christ's sonship is mediator. Is the ground and the reason of the erection of the throne of grace. Luke 2:10-11.
Luke 2:10-11. And the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord.
So again, the Christ's sonship, not simply as the eternal Son of God, but as mediator. That is the ground and reason for the erection of a throne of grace. He's come as a Savior. And we first come by faith to him who, as Elihu is noted, was formed of clay, so that we're not made afraid of the terror of God. Look at Job 33:6-7.
Job 33:6-7. Behold, I am according to thy wish, and in God's stead I also am formed out of the clay. Behold, my terror shall not make thee afraid, neither shall my hand be heavy upon thee.
I think it's a very interesting quote from Elihu. This idea that he's formed out of the clay like we are, so that we're not made afraid of the terror of God. We're able to approach God then, coming through him, we come to God as to a reconciled Father. Colossians 1:20.
Colossians 1:20. Having made peace through the blood of his cross, by him to reconcile all things unto himself, by him, I say, whether they be things in earth or things in heaven.
So, our adoption, then, is the ground for our access with boldness to this throne of grace, Hebrews 4:16.
Hebrews 4:16. Let us therefore come boldly into the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need.
God allows his children then to draw near to him with freedom, to pour out their hearts before him, to make all the requests known to him with confidence that if they ask anything according to his will, he hears them. 1 John 5:14.
1 John 5:14. And this is the confidence that we have in him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he heareth us.
Okay, so the advancement of our nature by reason of this union is such, ultimately, that we become adopted children of God, having direct access to the Father through Christ. In other words, the human nature has been advanced as high and as far as any created nature could possibly be. And we can't become God, but what we're to take away from this, I think, is this. What the Eastern Orthodox talk about in this respect, the deification of man, partaking of the divine nature, the idea that we become gods, small g, you are gods, I've said that you're gods. That's actually pretty close to what we're talking about here in the advancement of our nature. We're talking about a nature which is so highly advanced that we approach God as near and dear as any created nature ever could or would be able to. We've been advanced to a degree by reason of this assumption that was not attainable merely by creation. And our creation itself would not have accomplished what our redemption did. Our redemption has actually raised man much higher and placed him as a creature much nearer to God than simply his creation did. And at the center of all of this is what we call the hypostatic union, the eternal Son of God assuming to himself, taking unto himself human nature and living the life of a perfect man on earth that he might bring many sons to redemption, that he could be the captain of our salvation. Now you'll notice that a lot of the verses we looked at tonight were in Hebrews. Hebrews has a lot to say about this, but it's assumed in many other places throughout the Bible. Next time, what we need to talk about is the unity of the person that is Christ, and at that point, we'll observe some other things about this assuming of humanity, as well as the relation of the divinity to the humanity when we talk about the one person who is both God and man, which is Christ.